Happy Thanksgiving, podcast listeners. This is Kate Brown, the newsroom assistant here at ProPublica, bringing you a special episode before the holiday. And all of us here in the newsroom are giving thanks for you, our listeners, who make this show possible. We know that there are countless places that you can go to for your news, and it means so much to us that you trust ProPublica to bring you in-depth investigations that really matter. As a nonprofit, independent news organization, we need your help to shine a light on injustice and produce real, meaningful change with our work. Please go online to ProPublica.org/donate and make a contribution today. Thank you.
Welcome to the ProPublica podcast. I'm Eric Umansky. I am here with my colleague, Jesse Eisinger. And we are here with Masha Gessen, a much celebrated journalist who lived for, you said, about three decades in Russia.
Almost four, actually. Yeah.
Almost four. And wrote a incredibly depressing and incredibly powerful piece about what we as citizens should be on the lookout for now that we are in the era of Trump. And I thought what made sense today would be to talk about what we as journalists should be on the lookout for and how we should deal with it. Because in a sense, I feel like you're coming from the future.
Everybody should read the piece. It was in the New York Review of Books. So check it out.
So how screwed are we?
Oh, for one thing, it's obvious that the perils can't be direct, right?
Right.
The American media have a much longer tradition, a much more robust tradition, and are much financially stronger than the Russian media were when Putin came to power. At the same time, Russia had a newly invented, robust public sphere. And I think that in a sense, when we talk about journalism, we have to be cognizant of the fact that what we're actually talking about is the public sphere. And the public sphere is really what's under threat. Like, journalism is under threat because it's a part of the public sphere. But what autocrats of all stripes try to do immediately is put a damper on the public sphere.
So what else is part of the public sphere that you would define?
Civil society. I mean, civil society and the media create the public sphere.
Yeah. And so obviously he has, and he did it in the days after the election, effectively intimidated New York Times, effectively as in he has been intimidating the New York Times with his tweets, or at least mocking them. But what else have you seen that falls into that realm for you here?
Well, also his tweets delegitimize the protesters, and the protesters are certainly also part of the public sphere. There's talk, at this point, I have no idea how realistic this is, but there's this, like, that's been rising to the surface, this idea of restricting public assembly, which—
Is that something he floated? Is that—
I'm not even sure who floated it, but somebody has been talking about, economic terrorism and how protests can be restricted under the guise of economic terrorism. I mean, I think at this point it's very hard to tell what that's about. But I think what it does express is at least an understanding that the right to assembly can also be restricted, which is actually a great thing, that there is that understanding.
Which understanding?
The understanding that the right to assembly can be restricted. That's actually a very good reason to come out and protest.
Throughout the campaign, we saw Trump attacking the press, putting the reporters who were covering the campaign in pens. That was a bread and butter part of his stump speech. He called people out by name and then even talked about opening up the libel laws, whatever that means. Is that of a piece with what you're talking about?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, all of these autocrats, not just in Russia, but now the new European autocrats, use libel laws to attack the media and to create a chilling effect. And there's been actually, unfortunately, in the human rights community, in the free expression community, there's been a huge focus on criminal libel laws, which I think has been a little bit misdirected because, in fact, autocrats from ranging from Russia to Italy have been incredibly effective at using civil libel laws to bankrupt undesirable
sort of
media.
Seemingly less outrageous,
right? Right. And that's the courts, and the courts are independent, and so you can just go to court and you can get these ridiculous judgments. And then the judgments themselves create this this phenomenon of sort of profit-based censorship, which is very, very effective in Russia.
You mean it's essentially, it's just risk aversion, right? I don't want to get sued, and
I don't want to get sued, but also it distributes the responsibilities. And it's taken me years to be able to use the word censorship, because I used to be sort of a censorship purist and say that censorship is only prior censorship and it's only if it's exercised by the state. And finally, I think a couple of years ago, I had to say, no, we have to start using the word censorship to describe what's going on, because it is a state-engineered effective way of preventing things from being published. The fact that it works through private agents doesn't make it non-state enforced. So the way, for example, it works in Russia is that it distributes the responsibility for censorship. So why can't a book be published? Not because the publisher won't let it be published, or not because the state won't let it be published, but because the distribution department and the publishing house will tell the editor, there's no way we're going to get any bookstore pickups for this book, because they are afraid of being fined for carrying something that is potentially problematic. And so the profit motive is not to publish the book.
So then, I mean, that right obviously reminds me, without the state component yet, although potentially we're looking at one, of the Gawker case over the last year.
Absolutely, yeah. I think other people probably were writing about it too, but Nick Lemon wrote a wonderful piece about just what a dangerous precedent the Gawker case could set even before it was settled. It's absolutely terrifying. That's how you do it. That's how you shut down media that you don't like.
And of course, the Gawker case was funded by
right.
Peter Thiel, you know, allowing Hulk Hogan to go forward with his invasion of privacy case, and now Thiel is a major Trump supporter. So you have to sort of think that Trump may want to use proxies, and Thiel might want to use proxies to sue journalism organizations or journalists who criticize Trump or Trump allies.
I mean, it strikes me as a very difficult problem for media organizations who are, most of which are financially beleaguered in some sense or another, to combat. So, I mean, any tips that – I would wonder if, you know, whether it's coalitions, right? What are any mechanisms to combat that?
So that's where it gets more difficult, because obviously I have a lot of experience in failure. It's not like we can point to one country and say, look, you know, this is right. a country where the media and civil society banded together and were able to hold back autocracy. That hasn't really happened. I think that if there's one thing that makes the United States in 2016 different from other things that have come before, is that it has the luxury of other people's experiences. And I think that the one lesson that we really need to take from the failures of other countries and the media in other countries is that the battle begins right now, right? You don't actually wait to get attacked. You don't actually wait for the chilling effect to set in. We have very good reason to expect any number of things to happen, right? We don't know which ones of them will happen, but we understand the general nature of the threat. Right. Not just because it's happened in other countries, but also because Donald Trump has made it very clear. He's made it very clear that he dislikes the press. He's made it very clear that he distrusts the media. He's made it very clear that he sees it as part of the conspiracy against him. He's also made it very clear that he is not going to hold to the norms that have been established over many decades by previous administrations. There have been two incidents in 1 week of his specifically breaking with accepted norms. One was when he went to visit the White House and refused to take a press pool with him. Another one was his dinner at 21
without club.
21 club without the pool, which some journalists' reaction to it struck some people in the public as sort of a hissy fit, which it wasn't. And there was a great piece on Slate that explained exactly why it wasn't a hissy fit and why that's such an important part of the political culture.
Let me ask you another, what struck me as another norm breaking, I believe it was this morning, Trump tweeted that Ford had decided not to close down a plant, a car factory, essentially thanks to him, right? And it turns out that's simply not true. And it wasn't true beforehand, right? And it had been reported as the facts have been clear about that. I mean, it's just struck me as just audacious propaganda. I mean, that just seems like an accurate description of it.
Or you could just call it a lie.
Right. Right. And you can call it a lie.
How do you think the media did during the campaign, given that there was some perception of this threat? And the media is obviously a big, sprawling thing that means a lot of different things. There's the print media, Washington Post, New York Times, the leading outlets, the cable news. What do you think? I mean, did we perceive the threat and did we act accordingly or not?
No. It's easy for me to say because I write freelance and I write essays and books. But I think that, you know, the big papers, and I'm not even talking about television, which I think was a disaster, but the big papers, I think, failed on a very specific point, which is, and I'm going to borrow a metaphor from Garry Kasparov, the chess champion, who, when he first quit chess and went into politics, he was explaining to people that going up against Putin was like playing chess against somebody who keeps knocking the figures off the board. It's like he's not playing chess. And I think that what the papers failed to do was write the big story of the fact that Donald Trump wasn't playing chess. It's like the endless fact-checking was a little bit like reporting on a chess match by saying, okay, well, she opened, you know, e2 to e4, and he knocked all the figures off the chessboard. He knocked the bishop off the chessboard, and he knocked the knight off the chessboard. Well, just say it. Just say he was not playing chess.
So, you know, So play that out. What does that actually mean in practical terms? You know, what could have been done? What would a story look like or stories look like?
So then the question in the story would have been, you know, what is happening in our country instead of an election campaign, you know? And I think that it would have been a story of how Donald Trump is running for autocrat. I think at that point there should have been a big journalistic break with American exceptionalism, and that's where we would have gone to other countries to look at what has happened to other countries when politicians have run in democratic elections for autocrat. It's happened many times, and it's succeeded many times. It's easy to say in hindsight, but I think a good move would have been to fan out to countries that have had politicians run for autocrat, to run through those elections, to tell the stories of those elections and what happened after, to focus on the intricacies of the electoral systems and the vulnerabilities of democracy as such that enables politicians to run for autocrat.
So doesn't that require not only a kind of level of imagination in terms of framing and so forth, but it also has a kind of politically uncomfortable ramifications, right? If you are going to send a reporter to whether it's Zimbabwe or any place else and say, you know, we're going to talk about the parallels there, you are doing something that lots of journalists in America are very uncomfortable with, right? Which is taking what could very easily be seen as a kind of political position, right? You're describing something in clear terms, a conclusion that the Republican nominee for president, right, has autocratic tendencies, and just calling that what it is and reporting it within that framework, you know, is something that I think, you know, the profession would shy away from.
I think the question is, why do we think that saying that someone is running for autocrat is a value judgment rather than a statement of fact? It seems to me that in the case of Donald Trump, it's a statement of fact.
Mm-hmm.
The onus would be on the editor and reporter to talk through how that's a statement of fact and not a value judgment.
Mm-hmm.
But you can do that.
We're under a belief that American democracy is strong, that we're the longest continuous democracy in the world, the world has ever seen, that our institutions are powerful and can overcome the influence of one person, and that there's some innate goodness and justice in the American people. I think the press would have to overcome the myths of American society that they've grown up with their whole lives.
Sort of foundational truths.
Yeah, right? Exactly. I mean,
I think you're being awfully nice to that myth, because I think that myth is actually the myth of American exceptionalism,
yeah.
Which doesn't sound nearly as nice as what you just said. And the myth is that the American political system and the American culture is somehow superior to other countries. A priori superior. This is a superiority that you don't have to constantly prove.
One of the things you talked about writ large, and I think you've gotten at it, but it strikes me as a kind of powerful concept that I just want to put words to here, is that one of the most dangerous things is a failure of imagination at this point, right? That this is never going to happen. So, you know, no, Donald Trump, he's a joker. He's not going to be, you know, the nominee. There's no fucking way this guy is going to get elected, you know, after admitting to, you know, sexual assault and whatever it is, and on and on and on, right? And then you have the moment that I think, you know, we're now in seeing sort of the rear view mirror of let's all keep an open mind. He's not going to govern as he campaigned. And now you're seeing people who he's appointing who are very much in that vein, right? And so, I mean, in particular, I'm interested in going forward, what you think, what does it mean to not have that failure of imagination, right? To keep that open mind.
Right. So I actually wrote a piece about the failure of the imagination for the New York Review in the summer. And my particular critique at the time was that many reporters had gone directly from the state of total disbelief that Trump will never be the Republican nominee, even when he had the nomination locked in. And their argument, when I would ask people, they would say, well, I just can't imagine it happening. Well, if you can't imagine it happening, that's your problem. and you really need to problematize it. So we have to start actually by discrediting the phrase. Like when somebody says, I can't imagine it happening, that's a problem. But then what happened was that there was this whole direction of coverage that held incredibly to me, you know, for the entire campaign, this idea that Trump was somehow Putin's agent. And that Russia was meddling in the election, and that Russia was rigging the election. And, you know, there's a little tiny bit of evidence for it, but that's a classic conspiracy theory phenomenon where there's a little bit of evidence and, you know, it's, yes, some things have happened, but that's not what happened. What happened was an American phenomenon, a homegrown potential autocrat who was elected by Americans. And, you know, he has some Russian friends who maybe helped him a little bit, but that's not the story. Right, but I found that very telling because it was an attempt to other Trump, because it was so difficult to imagine that this was happening here, that it was actually easier to do this, you know, complete sort of bend over backwards maneuver that would position him as some sort of, you know, agent of Putin. And Hillary and Clinton's campaign, you know, ran with it.
I read the piece, and you were talking about the frankly, kind of fear-mongering ad that she had of, you know, the dark right. Russian.
That was actually a second piece on that. Oh. It was a piece on conspiracy thinking. So, yeah, I've been harping on this for a while. So, you know, that's part of it, part of an example of the failure of the imagination. Another is, and it continues with the keep an open mind. I think that we really have to unpack that entreaty to keep an open mind, because I think a large chunk of it is, again, I can't imagine what it would look like if he governed the way he campaigned, so I'm going to pretend that it's not going to happen.
Right.
Right. And, you know, Evan Osnos had this wonderful piece in The New Yorker in September, in which he imagined what a Trump presidency might look like. But he also pointed out that he had found out, and it had apparently been a surprise to him, that historically presidents have carried out over 70% of the promises that they had made during the campaigns, not necessarily because they so strongly believed everything they said or because they so strongly intended to do it, but because the campaign itself creates a political momentum that then carries forward. And that, I think that's a large part of what we're seeing with Trump. And in that sense, you know, the past is a lesson.
You know, if we were to the kind of news you can use aspect for journalists, right? I mean, it sounds like number one on the list is you must have the imagination of the possible, right?
And I think that it's not just, and make it even more specific, it's not just you must have the imagination, but that if you find yourself arguing through a story and you understand that I can't imagine it is one of your arguments, you know, go back to square one and start over, because that's the problem.
And what other sort of tools, whether they, you know, be frames of mind or whatever else it is, in order for journalists to prepare ourselves to be most effective in the place we are in now.
Right. So again, I would look at the world, and I would look for parallels and try to figure out whether whatever arguments we're trying to, you know, the way that we try to reason through stories holds up if we look at precedent. An example you used was, oh, you know, journalists were saying now all this stuff is coming out about Trump and women, and so that's going to derail the candidacy. Well, I've been there, and I hadn't, you know, I hadn't been there in Russia. I'd been there in a much more conventional political system when I was reporting on Avigdor Lieberman in Israel. Mm-hmm. Israel is a country that has prosecuted many of its highly placed officials. It's they've got a president who is either currently serving time or served time in prison for sexual assault.
Yeah.
And when I was reporting in Lieberman, a lot of people in Israel, this was like 2010, they were saying, oh, never mind, he's on his way out because there's this corruption scandal that's going to finally engulf him and derail him. And then it didn't happen. There was the corruption scandal. The corruption was proven. It was the sort of thing that would have derailed any traditional Israeli politician. And it didn't stick to Lieberman.
And Lieberman, just to, for folks who don't know, is a right-wing, you want to give him whatever description, ultra-nationalist, probably?
He's a right-wing ultra-nationalist. He's, but most important, he's a populist who's figured out a way to ride the wave of resentment politics that's quite similar to the wave that Trump is riding here and that is similar to populisms all over the world right now. Israel, in some ways, is one of the most instructive places to look at because the unraveling of Israeli democracy has been happening now for quite a number of years. And so we can look at what's happening. And also it's important because Israel had very strong institutions and a very sort of well understood and designed electoral system, much like the United States, and also had a lot of its, like the U.S., had a lot of its national identity invested in the beauty of the system and sort of the goodness of the country. And it turns out that populist resentment politics can overtake a lot of that, possibly all of that, but also in the specifics, right? So we have Lieberman, who turns out to be impervious to the kinds of things that would have damaged a different politician. That's a lesson that would have been very well learned in the summer and fall as more and more details were coming out about Trump. I don't think it's appropriate for us to think about outcomes, not because of, you know, an imaginary ideal of objectivity where we don't think about outcomes and just report what's out there, but just because I don't think we're smart enough to predict the outcomes. What I think would have been useful about looking around and understanding how misguided some of our conceptions of, you know, what can damage a politician could be, was that we then would have questioned the polls. Right. Because the thing about big data is, going back to the chess metaphor, it works on sports. Right. It works on baseball because baseball is played the exact same way year after year after year, game after game after game. If this is not chess, if this is not baseball, then the whole algorithm is invalidated. So that's where the journalistic question really should have been, is like, you're looking at the effects of the Access Hollywood tape in the context of an understanding of how politics works that has already been destroyed.
Right. I had this argument with people, you know, friends of mine who kept arguing that Hillary was so weak, kept saying, he's only 4 points down. That's not a lot.
Right.
I can't believe after the tape, after all this stuff, after the debate, when he said, I'm not going to accept the results of the election unless I win, everybody thought he's finished. This is the headline. And I kept saying, 4 points is a lot. It's a solid lead. Why would you say that? She's obviously got these reservoirs of strength that you're not recognizing because you're a Hillary basher. Obviously, I was completely delusional.
Look, I don't think you were delusional, right? And I don't think I was prescient, because I was convinced Trump was going to win.
You were.
But the
you
reason
were convinced.
I was absolutely convinced that he was going to win. But the reason I was convinced that he was going to win is because I've been reporting on these people, you know, mostly Putin, but a little bit of Lieberman, a little bit of Orban. I spent some time in Poland when I was reporting my most recent book. I've been seeing this happening everywhere. So my heuristic is that this is happening all over the world, and of course this is irreversible, and this force, when it emerges, is irresistible. The fact of the matter is that, you know, ultimately the outcome of this election was decided by something like 100,000 voters. Nobody was right in terms of predicting the outcome.
Right. So I have a potentially depressing question, which I think we've all been facing, you know, so in at ProPublica and like many other journalists, no, we're not prescriptive in terms of whatever policy, but we do want our journalism to have influence in some fashion, right? That's a reason why we do it. And, you know, I think lots of people, myself included, woke up and felt, well, all I have to wield are the facts, right? And shit, I don't know if that's a tool that's, you know, certainly I don't know that it's a tool that had the level of utility that I thought it.
Right. If we're living in a post-fact world with a post-fact electorate, what good are facts?
I don't go as far as he goes, but yeah.
Well, I think facts, there's a slight difference between facts and truth. And I think that when I talked earlier about the sort of the bigger story, another way of putting it is that we really have to figure out how to tell the truth and not just report the facts, right? Which is a pretty good sentence, but
right,
probably not a great, you know, not a great prescription.
What does it mean?
I mean, you know, really ask bigger questions, right? Bigger stories. It's horrible, but like any historical cataclysm, it can be invigorating and it can be a point of real sort of reinvention and institutional renewal. I would like create new beats, like the language beat, you know, language watch. What's happening to the American language? What's being marked? What's not being marked? I'll give you a very trivial example, but I've been involved with, in an argument with a couple of people about a story that came out in the Times yesterday about the National Book Awards. Right? So the National Book Awards was awarded on November 16th, and it was this beautiful evening, really, you know, just inspiring, wonderful, urgent, everything. The next morning, there's a piece in the Times written by Alexander Alter, who writes about books, and it said, it had a framing sentence, and the sentence was, many in the liberal-leaning publishing world were stunned and disheartened by the outcome of the election. And I thought, well, this is a fascinating framing sentence, right? Because it's doing something that most people won't notice, which is that it's marking something that is normal, thereby making it abnormal, right? The liberal-leaning publishing world. First of all, I have no idea what that means. Does it mean that there are two publishing worlds? One is liberal-leaning and the other one is not? Or does it mean that there's a publishing world, but it's liberal-leaning, right? The proper edit of that sentence would have been, the publishing world was stunned and disheartened by the outcome of the election. You don't actually have to mark it to state the fact. By marking it, you describe it as a... No, you show that it's not the norm, because whatever is marked is not normal. Whatever is not marked is normal, right? So I think it's hypercompensation on the part of the Times, which is hyper-aware of itself as liberal media at the moment.
Right.
But that's actually a moment to reflect and say, wait a second, we are normal. This is normal. Right now, it's normal. We understand that normal is going to drift and shift, and all sorts of things are about to happen. And part of our job is to notice and document how it's happening. We may or may not be able to influence the course of events, but our job is to at least be able to tell the story.
That's a good note to end on. As good a note as we can have.
Yeah.
Thank you for being here and giving us these very uplifting thoughts.
Oh, that's me, Masha, give you hope, guessing.
Thank you so much for joining us. And remember that ProPublica's podcast is produced with the support from our listeners. Go online to ProPublica.org/donate to make a donation that will go towards our mission to hold those in power accountable. Happy Thanksgiving, and we will see you next week.